background, I've worked for about 30 years in community economic development, and I'm a practitioner. Have worked in Canada, of course, with Aboriginal and rural and urban communities, and also in other countries as well. And my interest in public policy is really, which is what I'm talking about today, that so much of my experience working in the grassroots involved frustration of the way in which governments and other stakeholders were so often indifferent to what we were trying to do in our communities, or had policies and program regulations that made it very difficult for us to succeed in our work. And so I gradually moved from being a practitioner at the grassroots level to working in government to try and influence policy from inside, which had its own frustrations, of course. But I worked in local government, but then also I became a senior official in the government of British Columbia and helped to set up the Ministry of Community Development, Cooperatives and Volunteers for British Columbia, which was very much focused on trying to strengthen the social economy as a way of addressing the social, economic and environmental challenges that communities in that province were concerned with. And then I became executive director of the Canadian Community Economic Development Network, which is a national association of community-based organizations and practitioners, and through that organization tried to influence the way in which policy affected communities, again with that vision of from the grassroots creating policy that helps us to strengthen our work and strengthen the outcomes of our work. And now I pass that torch on to Mike Toy, our new executive director, and I'm co-director of the Social Economy Research Program in Canada. And that research program came out of advocacy by our organization and by the co-op movement and other organizations for some kind of government initiative to support the social economy, including a research program. And so that's how I'm here. We run a national center to support all the work that's going on across Canada, based in Victoria, with a partnership with the University of Victoria. And Annie will be talking a little bit more about the resources that are involved in that. And I'm just going to talk today about the public policy work that we're trying to do. And I really like the note here on the side here from your workshops yesterday. We need advocacy to go with the research, a way to ensure the results and make sure that they're tracked. And that's our approach to research, is it goes alongside advocacy to try and use the evidence that's generated from the research to influence the things that are blocking, that are barriers to the work that we're trying to achieve in our communities. So that's kind of a bit of a background. Last night I spoke about, we were okay for the next slide, I think. Last night I spoke quite a bit about Brazil, and so I'm not going to go back into that kind of material in any depth. But if there are questions that come up from last night that people have, please do ask them now as well. So what we're doing in terms of the national work is looking at the international and national picture in terms of how public policy impacts our work in the social economy. And also, we're looking at the kind of strategies that organizations are using to influence public policy. So what's working in terms of advocacy to try and get public policy rooted in the work that we do in communities? And there's a term in the literature around that, it's called co-construction, where civil society or community organizations and government actually collaborate in creating policy that builds on what's working in communities. And that's a kind of an important piece, because I think one of the things that we need to, that perhaps you may want to discuss in your breakout groups, is what kind of strategies can we use to create good policy in Nunavut to support the work that we do. We're also doing, an international and a national review of what's going on. And then we're doing also some work around some key thematics that are coming out of the research in the different parts of Canada that seem to have some national relevance. So issues around financing of social economy organizations, how can we improve that environment, how can we improve what we call procurement, and that's where governments and school boards and hospitals and colleges purchase goods and services. How can we try and make that purchasing benefit communities and return sort of a triple bottom line on those transactions, on those purchases, in terms of social, economic, and environmental benefits for communities. Looking at sort of management and governance issues, how can we strengthen the management arrangements for social economy organizations? We're looking at social enterprise development, how can we improve the creation of social enterprises, and then new business models for sustainability. So how can the social economy be a vehicle for dealing with climate change and dealing with the environmental challenges that our communities face? So the next slide. So we're doing an international lit review that's now been published, Advancing the Social Economy for Socioeconomic Development. And Crystal Tremblay, our geography PhD student at UVic, has been working on that. So that's now a published report. And it looks at all of the different discussions that are going on around the world in terms of the relevance and importance of the social economy. The next thing we're doing is analysis of key sort of policy instruments. By that I mean programs, legislation, policy developments that are going on in government that have good potential outcomes. And then the next publication, so there are going to be three from our national research, is a draft analysis of the next steps to strengthen the policy environment in Canada. And as part of that, we're doing engagement with folks like yourself in the grassroots and other stakeholders like credit unions on how can we strengthen the policy environment nationally and in the regions. So we're very interested in the outcomes of your breakout groups today because that will be a direct input in terms of thinking through what we should be recommending to governments. And we'll be doing other, we've done a session in Winnipeg, Saskatoon, Halifax, Calgary, so far, and we'll be doing others as well. So that we get out and hear what practitioners are saying needs to be done to support their work. And then we're going to submit all this wonderful material to what we've called a summit on building a people-centered economy. And that's going to be open to anybody that's interested in coming. It will be held in Ottawa in May, June of 2010. The idea is that it will be a place where people can come and debate a common agenda to try and strengthen the social economy in Canada. So from the literature review, we talked about this last night as well, so I'll go into a lot of detail, and many of the researchers in Sonoka have been making this point as well. You know, that we've always had a mixed economy in Canada, where there's a private sector, a state sector, and a third sector, which we're calling the social economy. And that third sector is made up of nonprofits, credit unions, cooperatives, and traditional and association-based production of goods and services for human and community benefit. So in terms of our indigenous nations and communities in Canada, the traditional land-based kinship-based ways of sustaining livelihood has always been a part of our Canadian reality. And that social economy is often, as we heard yesterday, ignored by economists and economic analysis. But it's actually one of the third pillar of our economy, and is absolutely essential to sustaining livelihoods in Canada. And it's significant. It's not a minor player in some parts of our country. It's probably, like here in Nunavut, probably, It's the major means by which people sustain their livelihoods. And I don't like using GDP as an indicator because I don't think it measures the right things. But even if you look at GDP, the social economy represents over 12%, and in employment terms, it employs more people than the entire mining sector in Canada. It's a very significant and very important contribution to sustainable livelihoods. And the other thing we're finding in the literature is that the economic downturn, the social challenges that we're facing, as well as climate change and environmental and ecological challenges, have spurred an interest in reforming the regulation of the economy generally, and the need for alternative models of development that integrate social, economic, environmental, and human needs using the social economy and people-centered approach. So there's a big debate in the literature about needing a new model of development that integrates economic and social and environmental considerations. And this is becoming mainstream. It used to be fairly kind of marginal debate and challenge to the traditional approaches to economics, but it's becoming a much more mainstream debate. So, for example, the Asia-Pacific conference that was held last week in Singapore, the communique that came out of that talked about the need for creating a more people-centered approach to development. And the G20 summit has also talked about various options in terms of trying to reform the economic system to reinvest in people and communities. Go to the next one. And so what we're seeing in the literature is definitely an evidence that the crises that communities are facing, economic, social, and environmental, are spurring a convergence of civil society around the concept of a social or solidarity economy. In English Canada, we've mainly used the term community economic development. In the Francophone world, économie sociale. In the Latin world, particularly in Latin America, they use the term economia solidaria. But the terms all basically refer to the same concept, building a people-centered approach to development that integrates social, economic, and environmental considerations. And there are growing networks about this. One of the other pieces of work that I do is I direct a global dialogue program on social economy. It's funded by the Mayer Foundation. It's based in Switzerland and is part of a whole series of examples of attempts to try and create a dialogue around the importance of the social economy as a way of addressing the global challenges. And there's increasing governmental support, which I'll come to in a minute in our research, but it's very clear in the debate that people are critical of the policy paradigms, the policy models, because they're so far behind the kind of socioeconomic models that people are actually creating on the ground. So the next slide. And then from the literature review, there's a couple kinds of discussion around what the social economy does, what kind of outcomes does it generate. And there's a whole literature, Paul Hawking, for example, Blessed Unrest, talks about the need for a new species capacity, a human capacity to act for the fusion of economic, social, and ecological goals. And that literature is full of all kinds of rich examples about how people are trying to do that. Ending poverty and social exclusion, addressing climate change, peak oil, sustainability issues, the need to relocalize economies so that we can reduce our carbon impact, changing economic systems of capital, trade, financing. A lot of talk about the importance of the social economy to territorial development in all kinds of different environments, how the social economy achieves inclusion for disadvantaged populations, human, social, and economic development, the whole microcredit movement, which was recognized by the awarding of the Peace Prize, the Nobel Prize, to folks at the Grameen Bank in Asia, and also very important literature around how these integrated models of development are key to indigenous self-determination and sustainable livelihoods. So what's the kind of policy instruments that are being used in different countries around the world? So in South America, the colonial history in South America means that many of the countries have constitutions that entrench the power of small elites and landowners, and essentially do not recognize the rights of majority indigenous populations in some of those countries. So in Ecuador and Bolivia, we've seen a big move to constitutional reform, which has entrenched the rights of indigenous people and all people to sustainable livelihoods in a plural economy. And in those constitutional reforms, the solidarity economy is actually specifically mentioned as a component of their development system. We've also seen efforts to integrate socioeconomic policy using the social economy as a key actor. And Manitoba and Quebec are the two provinces here in Canada that have taken some major steps to do that. And we heard from Nancy Niemtem yesterday about the developments in Quebec. We also see in many countries political responsibility and structure across the government to support the social economy. So in Quebec, that's taken the form of an interdepartmental committee and a cabinet minister responsible. In Manitoba, they have a CED committee of cabinet and a minister responsible, and then interdepartmental groups to try and bring all the departments together to support the social economy. The same has happened in Europe. There's also some interesting developments around legislating state requirements to support the social economy. So in Brazil, for example, all of the federal departments and agencies, as part of their annual budgeting process, have to demonstrate how they are supporting the social economy to reduce poverty and hunger. And as I said last night, even the airport authority has to prove that it's going to support the social economy. And they had difficulty doing that, but they did. They ensured that all of the retail produce that was being sold in airports in Brazil comes from local social enterprise producers to benefit the local communities. And then policy frameworks that support the social economy. In the European Union, they have a parliamentary committee, the European Parliament, on the social economy. They have a branch of the European Commission, the Federal Civil Servants, and the Parliament adopted a policy framework in February of this year that moves the social economy into the mainstream as a mechanism to address social and economic developments in the European Union. Program funding is a key piece as well. We heard yesterday about all the frustrations in terms of drive-by funding that organizations face. So in Manitoba and Quebec, they have, and the European Union, they have long-term funding. It's essentially core funding, 5 to 7 year time periods that just support the capacity of the organizations to do their work. There's growing support for social enterprise and co-op development in various jurisdictions. There's legislation and legal forms for social economy organizations where there's a problem with that. And then we heard from Nancy yesterday about measures to try and increase the access to capital with tax benefits for social economy organizations. And then procurement policies, as I explained, purchasing by state institutions in particular, advantage local social enterprises. The other piece, and I think some of the work of Sonoka has really focused on this and made us pay attention to this, and Francis's work has really paid attention to this, the importance of there being an explicit recognition of land-based traditional subsistence economies as a pillar of community economic development. And as I mentioned, Bolivia and Ecuador in South America are doing some very interesting things to make this a reality. Supports for youth engagement and leadership developments are another area that seems to be really important in terms of what people are doing in different parts of the world. And then there's also some interesting work around trying to introduce into education curriculum and programs some of these some of this history and reality about alternative economic models that young people should know about. And so just to sum up in terms of what's going on internationally, social economy Europe, the European setting, this is a major area of policy development. And in that setting, what happened was that the federations of the community development organizations, the non-profit groups, the cooperatives, the credit unions, decided to come together and form one federation, one voice for the social economy as a united movement to try and create human justice and social and economic development rooted in communities. In the United States, the Obama government has introduced an Office of Social Innovation in the White House, reporting to the president, that is looking at how they can support and build on these models of community, social, and economic development. They have a $50 million fund to support that, and they've been out of their stimulus, you know, their response to the economic crisis, they've been increasing the financing for community economic development organizations. The UK tends to use the word third sector, the term third sector, and they have a major initiative in England, also in Scotland and in Ireland, to support the third sector as a vehicle to try and support communities in Latin America. I've mentioned some of the initiatives there. In Asia and Africa, there are major initiatives as well. So we talked about this last night as well, but our assessment at this point is that Canada is lagging behind other jurisdictions. We did have a federal initiative in 2004, which had a cabinet minister responsible, had an interdepartmental committee, and had a round table of social economy organizations. And that was a major breakthrough, but that was canceled when the government changed. And so we lack that presence at the federal level. And there are problems in terms of, in our view, the stimulus and economic action plan at the federal level not reaching communities and people who need it the most. So there's lots of money going into infrastructure, and infrastructure is important, and construction trades workers need jobs as well. But there's nothing in our economic action plan that really is targeted to dealing with social aspects of infrastructure for communities. And we think that's a gap compared with other countries. We don't have a federal poverty reduction strategy, we have major problems around the commodification of foods or agricultural policies that make it very difficult to promote local food production and food security in communities. As the Premier here in Nunavut has noted, many communities have noted, there are serious issues around adaptation or dealing with climate change in that setting. But we're seeing good growth in social enterprises and cooperatives as we're seeing a growth in creating these kinds of new enterprising approaches to dealing with social and economic development. We're seeing growth in the fair trade sector. As I mentioned last night, Wolfsville, Nova Scotia, was the first municipality to declare itself a fair trade town, which meant it would do all it can in its purchasing and in promoting local fair trade producers, as well as international fair trade processing. 16% growth last year in the whole of the fair trade sector across the world, in the teeth of a recession. So I think it indicates that people are voting with their wallets in terms of wanting to see ethical purchasing, wanting to see every dollar they spend try and contribute to the well-being of our communities. Some good progress in terms of provincial territorial governments looking at how we use the social economy to reduce poverty. Newfoundland and Labrador has done some work on this, Quebec, Manitoba, and there's a growing number of them. We've mentioned the Quebec and Manitoba provincial government strategies that are models, I think, to look at, to adapt to other jurisdictions. Municipalities are getting into the act. Edmonton in Alberta has a social enterprise trust that they invested $3 million out of their own tax base. I realize hamlets here in Nunavut don't have the same ability to do that. But nevertheless, interesting municipal example where the municipal government essentially said, this is so important to revitalizing our neighborhoods and serving our citizens that we're going to put our money where our mouth is, and then they look across, they leverage that three times over with donations from the private sector and foundations, etc. So what does this tell us in terms of what we could do as practitioners? It's clear, looking at Quebec and Manitoba and the international examples, that where there's been some sea changes, where there's been some major shifts in the policy environment to support our work and our organizations, it's because people have united. It's because people have reached out to one another across the different areas that they work in, whether it's community nonprofits or cooperatives, credit unions, all of these different subsectors of the social economy coming together to create a united voice around their common values and what they're trying to achieve for their people and communities. That's where the ground has shifted in terms of the policy environment. Clearly that's what happened in Quebec. Nancy kind of referred to some of that history. What's happened in Manitoba as well. The other part is that it really is important to create an enabling environment for the social economy to achieve its outcomes. In all of the research that we've done, it's very clear from the practitioners that if there isn't an enabling, they don't want government. They don't want top-down government policy. They don't want top-down government direction of what they should do. They want an enabling environment so that they can get on with the work that they know needs to be done and build effective and good practices. So what that looks like in Nunavut, I don't know, but maybe that's a point that people might want to discuss when we go into our breakout rooms. And then the other key point is that the practitioners are the one that know what needs to be done, and that is absolutely critical that what is developed in terms of policy fits with the different regions and community realities. And here, of course, that means being concerned with what's relevant to Arctic and northern communities. Just the final point there is that we need to engage across government so that we're trying to dialogue with all elements of government. So these are the questions I'll leave you with. What key policy initiatives could help your work here in Nunavut? How can we build greater cooperation amongst your different organizations, the actors in the social economy here? For our colleagues in government, what do they need to work with us to create a stronger social economy? Many of our colleagues in government wear many hats as well and are passionate about wanting to help communities. So we need to be working with them and asking them how we can work most effectively. And then the final slide is just that's just some contact information with the website for the Social Economy Hub, the website for the Canadian CED Network, and that's my email. So thanks very much, and do you want to take questions now? Yeah, if there are any questions or comments, I'm very much welcome. Yes?
You can see where, as you said, by 2004, as you said, there was a sea change, again, with a very right-wing government put in, who does not value, and whose platform, if we understood, is rather frightening. But at the same time, the average person doesn't realize when they're going up to the poll how right say, you're on your own, you have full responsibility for yourself, and we are not our brother's keeper. And so we're functioning right now in one of the most extreme right-wing governments. The Reform Party took over conservatives. The conservatives did not take over the Reform Party. And most people don't know that. And when we're trying to work, you know, together in an environment where government has pulled more and more and more of the pillars out from under our social platform, and Canadians think they still have one, and it's been being, you know, pulled out from under us. So it's extremely bad environment we're in with our current government, because they do not recognize, and their whole platform over 100 years does not recognize the need to look after one another.
Yes, I can't disagree with you.
Yeah.
One of the things that says so is how do we get the message across to the public about the work that we're doing and the ways in which it's blocked or undermined? And that for me is a gap in the current research, is how do we create better capacity to use communication to get the story across to the public, the important area. Yes, please.
I'm really encouraged in the way you're presenting this information and how a people-centered policy development approach is, it's very different. And in Nunavut, we see a deep need to empower local people to help governments focus on the real issues. How do you find the governments playing a role in this process?
A couple of examples, maybe. The developments in Manitoba were partly the consequence of the government of Manitoba being willing to resource the CED network in the province to engage practitioners on the ground in identifying what those key issues are for communities. And then being willing to sit down at the table and listen to what those practitioners had to say, and then create the means by which to take action within government. So they created a CED lens that meant that the government officials had to look at how they were supporting community economic development. And that lens was created through a dialogue with practitioners. But then most importantly, as the issues became identified by debate amongst the practitioners, the government then responded by creating the working groups of the responsible officials to sit down at the table and thrash out, so how can we address this issue? The same thing happened in Brazil, where the federal government in Brazil, instead of creating a big policy framework and imposing it on folks, resourced a network of all of the practitioner organizations, women's organizations, organizations of the landless, indigenous organizations, cooperative organizations, etc. They created a network to engage the grassroots in identifying what the issues and the blockages were in their work, and continue to fund that network to essentially be the voice of a united social economy movement. And then they created a government structure with a minister responsible that had the political authority to take action on the issues that emerged from the grassroots. So those two models, it seems to me, are the ways in which you can really government can react by supporting the engagement amongst the actors in the social economy and then take action on what comes out of it, rather than having a good idea, creating a bureaucracy, and then imposing it on the communities. So that's the kind of policy process that I think is needed.
Thank you.
Rupert, I know in Atlantic Canada, the Atlantic Canada Opportunity, COA as we call it, the Atlantic Canada Opportunities Agency is not blind to the social economy, and there are examples where that organization has supported the social economy. Do you think that the formation of the Canadian Northern Economic Development Agency presents new opportunities for Northerners with respect to the social economy?
Very good strategic question at this moment in time. I think it could do. And the regional development agency, so in the West, for example, Western Diversification Canada did redefine its programs to include social enterprises. Previously, it would only fund private business, for-profit business, some of which also had social values, so that's okay. But it excluded cooperatives, it excluded non-profit organizations, and their sort of economic activities. So they changed their program guidelines and said, no, we can't support that. So it's uphill battle in the current political environment, but the officials in that department are moving through projects that support non-profits and cooperatives. So the same, and it's the same, I think, with APOA, you know better than I do, they have supported some initiatives with the co-op sector in particular. So there's the same opportunity with the Northern Development Agency. The warning I would make is that unless you voice the need for the agency to be responsive to the way in which communities are real here in Nunavut, they'll just focus on mining and gas and energy as the traditional economic kind of drivers in their minds, not traditional in your minds. So that's the key, I think, is to make sure your voice is heard in ensuring that agency is responsive to the realities of your communities. Paper that compares Quebec and Manitoba that's available on the SEDNET website. It was authored by John Loxley. It's a bit long, but there's an executive summary that does kind of explain that development. So you're very welcome to obtain that, and you can always contact me if you need any help with that.
Okay. And the second comment is that I think Kenmore, the work that's being done up here, they are responsive to the needs. And when you look at the industries or the initiatives that are being funded, they're quite aware. So I think that there's lots of opportunity to work with them, and that they obviously are. Mining is one of the pillars, but it's not all of the
not the only
all of
thing.
The energy that's being.
Good, that's good to hear. Thank you.
From our panel yesterday that had the northern perspectives, I think we heard a strong voice about the need for unity. And we also heard from your presentation this morning how social economy organizations needed to have someone to be a voice for them. Just in discussions in the group here, I've heard about the Coalition for Anti-Poverty in the Yukon, Alternatives North in the Northwest Territories. But maybe I want to put this question to the group. Who's going to speak for Nunavut? And what are we going to do when we leave here at 12?